ISW testing. At this time, we begin the technical matter. I'm KQ Romeo, India Whiskey. My name is Dick. You'll also hear John, KC2WGB, Paul, WS2N, and K2K6, KPZ. How? That group of guys tries to organize this enthusiastic group of people that meet most Sunday evenings to discuss their favorite subject, the hobby of ham radio. There are 26 different kinds of ham radio, and this particular repeater in the New York City area tries to cover northern New Jersey, southern New York State, most of Long Island, western Connecticut. There's a lot of brain power in that New York City metropolitan area. By way of Echolink and IRLP, we also get check-ins from much further distances in other states and other countries. We have to make sure that we periodically give a long enough pause so that the people in the outer areas get a chance to sign in. Let me drop. And we got to try, each time you get a turn to talk, try to listen now long enough to hear all four beeps and don't respond immediately. Otherwise, you'll time out the machine, which I do rather frequently. A person signs into the technical net by giving that group of people your call letters, your name, and the word yes, which means you do have a question or a comment for the net. During the first hour or so, we take general questions, usually of ham radio nature. That's followed by John, KC2WGB, going to the mailbag for the people who don't yet have their ham license or the right kind of equipment so that they can sign in live and talk to us live. The TechNet is in general not intended to be a free written consulting service. You get your answers live on the air, if you know what I mean. And that's followed by Paul, WS2N, who tells us what National Aeronautics and Space Administration has been doing. Hal will periodically give us a more brief answer based on all of his experience with an awful lot of test equipment. Take a look at his website sometime, and you'll see the number of pieces of equipment that he personally owns. It fills up six cellars full, so to speak. Let me drop. You need that sign in just because you're listening. This is TechNet number 1498 of the series that began 31 years ago, roughly September of 1982 is when the TechNet began. And so it's been around a long time, much to my amazement. Into FDJ, Hip and I, way back in 1982, thought we'd answer people's questions about how ham radio equipment works. We thought it would take a couple of weeks, maybe a couple of months. The questions would be answered, we'd dry up and go away. Here we got 31 years later. Okay, you're going to give me your call letters and your name right now if you want to check in. K2LIW in the TechNet. Okay, Kilo Delta 2, Charlie Tango, India. You didn't give us your name, and you didn't say whether or not you do have a question or a comment. Charlie Tango, India, go right ahead.
This is Arnie, and I do not have a question for the TechNet tonight.
Pretty fine, Arnie, and that was a no. You guys will know that starting at 9 o'clock on Channel 5 will be the second session of Cosmos, the updated one 30 years later by Neil deGrasse Tyson. And one of the things that's interesting if you're an over-the-air television watcher is that the previous week's session of Cosmos is repeated on Saturday night between 8 and 9 o'clock. So between 8 and 9, I said 8 and 9 is 9 and 10. Between 9 and 10 o'clock tonight will be Cosmos. And I guess it's going to go on for something like 13 weeks. Anyone else to check in because you do have a question or a comment for the net? Give me your call letters and name right now. K2LIW.
WS2N, Paul with the Space Report. And Cosmos was, it was Saturday from 8 to 9, but tonight's 9 to 10. There.
Glad you gave me that correction, Paul. I thought it was almost the same time. So it's 8 to 9 on Saturday, the previous week, and 9 to 10 is the on Sunday is the new session for that particular week. Okay? Anyone else to check in with a question or a comment for the TechNet? Give me a call, letters, name, right now.
52, Bravo, my papa. Yes? Joe?
Okay, I heard Peter check in because I'm hearing him on the input, but he may not have his TL turned on because I didn't hear him on the output. I heard Baker, Mike, Peter, Joe, and what's your prefix on that one, Joe?
Whiskey 2, Bravo, Mike, Papa, Joe.
We got you, Joe. Okay, there was another person trying to check in, which I heard on the input, but not coming through the machine. Give me your call letters again, K2LAW. V2OAY, Joe?
Yes.
I heard you say you're not making the machine. I didn't hear you coming through at all, but I'm hearing you nice and loud in the input. I heard Joe, RYY. And who was that person again that's not making the machine? And maybe your PL is not turned on, 136.5. Give me your call letters again. Hey, you're nice and loud on the input, Peter, WA2PAA. But I'm not hearing you through the machine. So it could be a PL problem, or your antenna is not aimed at the repeater. However, since I'm hearing you so on the input, I will take your question when your turn comes up. One last call. So far, we've got Arnie with a no, Joe with a yes, Joe number 2, RYY, with a yes, Peter. Anyone else to check in? Give me your call letters right now.
Name is John. No.
And yes, have a question.
Okay, I heard Don with a no, and then I heard yes, I have a question. Yes, I have a question. Give me your full call letters, sir, and name.
Victor Alpha 3, Papa Zulu Golf. The name is Al, and yes, with a question.
B2BXO, Frank, and yes, I have a comment about one of our members who's passed.
Okay, BXO, I heard you, Frank. Victor Echo 3, Al, I think that was. Give me those callers again, Victor Echo 3.
Yeah, it's actually Victor Alpha 3, Papa Zulu Golf. The name is Al, A-L, Alpha Lima.
Okay, Victor Alpha 3, Papa Zulu Golf. We got you, Al. And BXO, BXO, go right ahead with your information. Go ahead, Fred. Okay, maybe he's not ready at this time. Whiskey 2, Baker, Mike, Papa. Go right ahead with your question or comment, Joe. K2LAW, my name is Dick.
Thanks, Dick. I'm a QRP guy, and I do a lot of field work using simple dipole antennas. And my question is, how much does the chemistry of the physical wire on the dipole affect the efficiency of the antenna? Have you done any experiments with that?
Left-handedly, I have, Joe, number one. I've done a lot of work over the last 10 years at 900 megacycles. I was developing a whole series of antennas for which my name is on the patent application at 900 mega antennas that all start off with a dipole as the basic exciting element, and most of them were Yagis, but not all of them. Some of them were also turnstile-like things and monopoles and whatever. It's a little bit similar to what happens when a guy builds an 80-meter dipole. He starts with a 132-foot-long piece of wire to be half-wave. He uses 14-gauge household wire. And he asks the question, will the antenna work better if I remove the rubber insulation from the wire, or can I leave the rubber insulation on? What really happens is the RF energy goes right down through the rubber until it finally finds some real conducting material down below. By the same token, I'm reasonably sure that even the copper oxide you'd have on ratty old copper wire, let me drop it. You might have some ratty old copper wire that was soaking in salt water for some length of time, or in your humid cellar without any insulation on it, and it turned tarnished. And because the wavelength is, what, 80 meters, we'll say, for instance, where the wavelength is around 260 feet long, 80 meters, the wire diameter is such a small fraction of a wavelength that as long as it is a moderately good conducting material, if you made your dipole out of nichrome wire, you would definitely lose some insulation. You would definitely lose some efficiency because that's known to be very resistive. But as long as deep down inside your surface, there really is a conducting material, and it's not just a green tarnish all the way through. As long as the RF energy can go down there and find some real conducting material, it's going to do its thing, and you're going to get moderately good efficiency. If you have any doubt, there's a very good way you can test it. If you're looking for the absolute maximum in sensitivity, you would put a watt of power into your dipole and look at it with a thermal imaging camera. However, you and I have got a much better way. You take your dipole put 100 watts of power into it for 10 minutes or 5 minutes, turn up the power, walk over there and touch it. It's an extremely sensitive test because your hand can easily tell the difference between a couple of degrees of rise in temperature of the wire after it's been heated with RF as opposed to before you heat it with RF. The only way an antenna can be inefficient is it takes some of the valuable RF energy and turns it into heat. There is no other method of inefficiency. Let me drop. And I'm talking about the antenna itself. Yes, if you and I mounted an 80-meter dipole 5 feet off the ground, and depending on the resistivity of my soil, I'm launching a lot of that RF energy into the nearby soil, which is a volumetric resistive material, and I'm going to be heating up the soil. In the wintertime, I'm going to make the worms down there warm and happy. But, you can make the radiating system inefficient because of what's nearby. But the antenna itself, there is no mechanism by which it can be inefficient other than turning the power into heat, and you and I have got a beautiful way of detecting that heat. In the case of a VHF antenna, which is relatively small in size, you put 100 watts into the antenna, and if it runs ice cold, even if it gives you an amount of heat that your hand can easily detect, 1 watt of power out of 100 watts, that's like 0.03 or whatever dB of loss. In other words, you would not even be able to measure it on a single strength meter. It would be less than the width of the needle on an old-fashioned Dawson dial movement type meter. So when in doubt, on any antenna, any frequency, pour some power into it, turn it off, go over there and touch it. You'll know right away if you've got inefficiency. If it's essentially cold, then it's 100% efficient. If it's a little bit warm, there's various techniques by which you can estimate how many watts of warm you got versus how many watts of power you applied. And there's a fairly simple formula you can apply to figure out your real percentage of efficiency. I think 99% of the time, Joe, you're worrying about something that need not be worried about, but it's still a darn good question, and we're talking about conservation of energy here. W2, Baker Mike Peter, K2RIW. What the hell are you about to put up that antenna, Joe? Go ahead. I'll recognize, but Joe first. Go ahead, Joe.
Thank you so much, Dick. I think my question was the actual metallurgy, the composition of the wire for the antenna, does that affect performance? In other words, if I had so much percentage of copper and so much percentage of nickel to actually make up the wire for the dipole, do you have any experience in that, how that affects the efficiency of the antenna?
If your ohmmeter says you've got a real conductive material, then it's hard to make it inefficient. But if it's inefficient, it's going to show up as heat when you put some power into it. But maybe Hal's been down this road already with inefficiency of dipoles. K6DPZ, K2RIW, go ahead, Al. K6DPZ, you said you had a comment to make, Hal. Go right ahead. Maybe Hal got called away, or maybe his rig, some of these rigs where you press the button and it hops off to some other crazy frequency. So when Hal comes back, we'll get his comment. There's a kind of copper-clad wire, for instance, which is really steel core with copper on top, because of the so-called skin effect, in other words, at most of the RF frequencies you and I work with, Joe, the RF energy only goes down about 1/10,000 of an inch. 0.1 thousandths of an inch is where all the conductivity takes place, on the surface of the conductor. And so if the steel core is there, as opposed to being solid copper, the RF energy would never know the difference. In many cases, you can make a copper tubing do what you want, and you don't really need the solid copper all the way through. So your ohm meter will tell you pretty fast if you've got a resistive material. And if the ohm meter shows you that it's reasonably low in resistance, like some number of ohms per 100 foot, then I wouldn't worry. But the real confirmation would be to put power into it and see if anything gets hot. Let me see one more time if Hal did come back. K6DPZ, K2RIW, go ahead, Hal.
K2RIW, K6DPZ, I grabbed the wrong microphone, Dick, that's what happened. The point was, in kennel wire, what would be suggested is keep a dirty type of kennel wire?
Yeah, he's not only dirty wire, but if it's made out of some kind of composition, like if he's using nickel copper, nickel steel, things like this, he wants to know, is he going to get inefficiency? Wait for the beeps, Hal, when I send it back to you. K6DPZ, K2RIW.
K2IS. K2IS station's in there also. Well, being that you mentioned it's true, the skin effect, the main radiation and everything conduction is on the outside of the wire. The lower the frequencies, the more into the wire it is. And at RF frequencies, it's more on the outside. A copper-clad wire would work. One of the most common wires used if you're going to make a dipole, and it's not that expensive, is number 12 to 14 electrical wire with plastic insulation on it, or plastic rubberized insulation. That would not tarnish, and it works very efficiently, and it's not that expensive because you can buy an electrical supply. Go ahead, Nick.
Very fine, Hal. Bill recognized AC2IS. We'll get to you in a second. Many guys will leave the rubber insulation on. That way the copper stays nice and fresh underneath, doesn't get exposed to the weather. But lots of guys have a dipole with bare copper wire out in the weather for long periods of time. It gets tarnished, it looks green, looks ugly. As long as you've got good electrical contact where your balun meets the dipole, I think it's very difficult to make a dipole inefficient. Yes, if I made out of nichrome wire, which is wire known to be high in resistivity, I'm going to get some loss. However, even if you made it out of lossy wire, my gut feel is that the way the energy bounces back and forth on that wire before it gets radiated, even if you did feel some heat when you put 100 watts into it, that might only be 1 or 2 dB worth of heat, which is a very small fraction of one S unit on your S meter. Would the guy you're talking to really know the difference? But the thermal test, I think, is the best one. Bill, what's your question along these lines? AC2IS, K2RIW in the TechNet.
KD2CXK with a quick comment.
This is AC2IS, and my question, Dick, was about copper-clad aluminum used for Ethernet cabling. Generally, people are taught to look for those things. A lot of times, copper-clad aluminum will be sold for cabling without notice. Generally, that's thought to be much lower quality. If you put a meter on it, you can detect the difference. There is some higher resistance with copper-clad aluminum. That's 23 or 24 gauge cable. It's differential signaling used in Ethernet. And I was wondering how significant you thought that would be.
CD2K with a quick comment.
CXK recognized. I picked up the wrong mic again also. And that was Craig. The copper-clad aluminum, I think, is not a problem. Again, because of the skin effect. If the outside layer is copper, no problem. If the outside layer is aluminum, I think there's almost no problem. You get a little bit more resistance with aluminum. Various guys have taken aluminum grounding wire and built a dipole out of it. And the big problem, of course, is making a good joint to the aluminum at the center. Soldering to aluminum is a real art form, not easy. And even if you did do a good job of soldering, I think when it's out in the weather, there is a possibility it develops a crack and aluminum oxide that crawls underneath the solder joint and eventually makes you a scratchy contact. I would only trust an aluminum-fed element of a dipole if I'm feeding it away from the center, like by way of a folded dipole or T-match or gamma match. Then, under those circumstances where you're really feeding the dipole at a higher impedance point further away from the center, then the exact resistivity doesn't matter. But a person who takes aluminum rods and makes a dipole out of it, and he thinks he's going to get real good contact in the center, where milliohms of resistance in the center of a dipole can make some loss of problems. In the case of, say, for instance, a Yagi, where the dipole might have only 20 ohms. Let's see what Craig's got to say on all this. KD2CXK, K2LIW. Go ahead, Craig.
KD2CXK. What I've used, and you're going to say the composition of the metallurgy is a little unkosher, but I've had incredible results with it as far as weather protection, is the green rubberized galvanized number 14 cable that you can buy at Home Depot. I love this cable. It is kind of a memory spring effect, so it always kind of goes to, you know, it doesn't tangle very easily, which makes it great for a quick takedown dipole, but I use it extensively in Connecticut. It's been there for a couple of years. I have very good performance out of it, even on QLP. And it's, like you had mentioned, you gotta mate it correctly. And let me let it drop for a second. What I find works very well is if you're going to transition two different metals, that you do it in a, you coat it with something to kind of keep the rain away from that, because or else you're going to get galvanic action to similar metals and corrosion. I find an oil base works something good, some dielectric grease. And then I heat shrink it, and I've gotten 3 years corrosion-free performance there. It's very inexpensive. It's incredibly strong, and it works well. But you may come back with different results on the metallurgy. KD2CXK, back to Nick.
Craig, you gave a beautiful testimonial for what I think is galvanized steel wire. I'm not quite sure. I think you said you bought it at Home Depot. Give us the name of the stuff one more time. I know that the Montgomery Ward catalog used to sell 9-gauge galvanized steel wire, which I used to use for guy wires. It's not the most recommended stuff in the world. I pull tested it, and it's good for 900 pounds, which on a light towel might be good enough. So what's the approximate price of this stuff? What's the approximate gauge? And is it the galvanized steel wire that you're talking about that you bought at Home Depot? 82CXK,
K2LAW, go ahead, Craig. It's galvanized steel. The wonderful part about it is it's rubberized. It actually has a very durable, tight rubber jacket on it, which is a green translucent, so you can't see the cable inside of it. I think it's 14 gauge. I think I paid about 24 cents a foot, if memory serves me. And I've made dipoles, I've made long wire elements, I have a hoop in a bag in my QRP backpack. It is almost tangle free, the only thing you have to worry about, of course, is mating it to your feed line, because odds are that's going to be copper, and now you're going to have a dissimilar metal joint there. So what I've done is I've used a copper wrap, so I've mated them end to end, overlapping about 3 inches, copper wrap, coated them in dielectric grease, and then heat shrunk it. And I take that off once a year to double check it, and it's perfect. I have no problems. It seems to withstand all weather. Back to net.
Yeah, galvanized and copper are dissimilar metals. In direct contact out in the weather, they will give you some tarnishing eventually. However, copper is beautifully compatible with solder. Galvanized material, zinc, is beautifully compatible with solder. Therefore, when you solder the two together, where now there's really a layer of solder in between, if you've done a good job of wetting it, so to speak, with solder, you've now made a thoroughly compatible joint, as I see it. So I think the bottom line of all this, Joe, is that you've got to really go some to find material that's resistive enough that you're going to get a measurable amount of loss or wire would be pretty terrible. Galvanized steel wire, I know, is pretty good. Aluminum wire, as long as you can make good contact to it, I know is good. Copper clad wire, I know is good. So copper covered aluminum wire, I know is good. So most of the materials you're likely to make a dipole out of, I think you're going to get 99% efficiency out of it, Joe. But by way of that thermal test, you can do an acid test that's basically traceable to the bureau. If it runs cold with 100 watts for 5 minutes, you've got an efficient antenna, Joe. By the way, when you do use whatever material you're going to use, and if you ever do make any kind of a measurement that gives you a hint of its efficiency, please come back and tell us what you found out, Joe. W2BMP, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Thanks very much. It wasn't a question of inefficiency. It's a question of, does any chemistry work better than another for the wire? And I'm running some tests, and I'll continue to run some tests, and if anything comes up, I'll let you guys know. Thanks to everybody on the net. Thank you, Dick. Whiskey 2 Bravo Mike Papa will be on frequency listening.
Now, when you talked about chemistry, and you talked about various methods of making the wire, I thought you were talking about efficiency. When you talk about chemistry, are you now talking about whether or not it will deteriorate in the weather? Was that your question, Joe? We may have been way off to one side. BMP, K2LIW.
Yeah, that's exactly the question. I'm involved with the chemistry of the wire, and in backpacks, camping, you know, it's going to get wet. It's under a whole bunch of different adverse conditions, hot, cold. Did you have any experience with specific type of chemistry, you know, under various conditions? Whiskey 2 Bravo Mike Papa, back to you.
My experience and the experience of many people on this net, where they have used galvanized steel wire successfully, aluminum wire successfully, pure copper household wire successfully, copper clad steel, copper clad aluminum, I'm having trouble believing that you can find a wire that with your particular environment is going to eventually give you trouble. It may look a little bit homely. RF-wise, it's going to continue to perform. But Craig's solution there, where this wire is automatically covered with a protective coating, and therefore it's going to easily not tangle the stuff that he bought at Home Depot, and always look pretty. So if it's the beauty of the wire you're concerned about, and that kind of chemistry, or maybe you're going to have a salt spray environment where you're operating a seaside with your QRP equipment, I think what Craig's got is an awful good solution. Let us know what you discover on this one, Joe. Joe, number two, is the next guy, W2RYY. He usually has some pretty mind-bending questions. What do you got for us tonight, Joe? W2RYY, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Maybe a little noisy here. Oh, the simple question I had for you was, did you watch 60 Minutes, and did you look on the part about the drones? It's an interesting program tonight. Did you have to catch that? That's my question to you.
I sure did, Joe. What Joe RYY is telling us, and he's a little bit noisy, a little bit low in audio, is that the second of the three segments of 60 Minutes tonight between 7 o'clock and 8 o'clock was on these radio-controlled drones, which I have been seeing for the last 5 years in a row at the NEAT Fair, NEAT, Northeast Electro-Aero Technology. It's a great big conference that's held in the Catskills of New York. Chernobyl, New York, is the name of the town, at a campsite, at a probably 150-acre campsite, and you get something like 300 radio-control pilots coming together with about 100 different vendors of radio-control equipment. But a significant number of these guys are flying these hexacopters, quadricopters, whatever, these radio-controlled helicopter-like things with built-in stabilizers. Quite a few of these guys are doing what's called first-person piloting. That really means there's a camera on board. By way of a radio link, the signal being picked up by the camera is sent back to the pilot, and in some cases he's wearing a headset. Let me drop. In some cases he's wearing a headset where he is looking at the picture live, and these things can be flown. So far they have already been flown down the streets in New York City. One of the beautiful pictures you saw tonight was a drone was flown about 50 feet or 100 feet above Niagara Falls, and you look straight down Niagara Falls with this helicopter with a camera that's steerable. The FAA has not yet really discovered how to write laws to limit these things, and whether or not they're an invasion of privacy. Senator Feinstein is really worried about that, the head of the Intelligence Committee. She thinks some rules have to be written. She's a little bit afraid that if she looks out the window of her house and sees a drone out there looking in her window taking pictures, is that an invasion of privacy? However, the life we live these days, all of our metro areas have got all kinds of cameras. Many of the traffic lights have got cameras. So we're being looked at with cameras all the time. So is a flying camera, a drone-like flying camera on this unmanned aerial system, unmanned aerial vehicle. They've got various names for them. But they're here to stay. Very useful devices. Farmers, for instance, will fly them over a field to find out which part of the field needs more insecticide or needs more water. Firefighters will get an aerial view of a fire to know where they should apply their resources. Let me drop. In many disaster situations, fire departments are starting to use them. Law enforcement departments are starting to use them. The military has been using them for a long number of years, and the serious radio control enthusiasts have been using them for at least 5 years, to my knowledge, if not considerably longer. Nowadays, you can buy a kit with one of these things for under $1,000 with the camera and with the feedback system, with the stabilization and so on. They fly for numbers like 6 minutes, maybe even as much as 16 minutes, depending on how much battery on board. These brushless DC motors are being used on electrically powered, radio-controlled model airplane these days, are getting to the point where the total power you're getting out of these electric motors is, in general, greater than the energy you used to get out of a reciprocating internal combustion engine. So electric-powered vehicles with radio control, they're here to stay. So saw that one. Anyone have any further comments on that particular 60-minute show tonight, give me a call. Let us right now. K2LIW in the TechNet.
You too, Bravo Mike Papa with a comment.
WS2N.
Okay, we heard both Joe, Pete, and I think, I know I heard Joe first. BMP, go right ahead, Joe.
Yeah, I'm an avid quadricopter flyer, first-person video. It's really designed, what they did was they took a home security video camera adapted for flying use. That's at the amateur level, and it's at 5.8 gigahertz, and the resolution is absolutely outstanding. As a matter of fact, I was flying one today and looking at my roof. It's just amazing, and the video is clear. I use a GoPro as the camera, and just incredible. Back to you.
Good to know, Joe, number one. Thank you. Huh. I could be looking at my top of my tower that way with one of these things to get a closer view. As I do it right now, I set up my telescope in the front yard, looking at my tower to figure out what piece of servicing I should be doing next before I climb the tower and carry the right tools with me. Who else wanted to make a comment on this one? Give me a call. Let us right now. K2RIW.
WS2N.
Paul recognized. Go ahead, Paul.
After the 60-minute show, I looked up these little units, and some of them a little smaller than what they were showing on 60 Minutes, but you know they were quads, and they had the camera, 2.4 gig, and then you know for the remote control, and then a higher frequency I think for the camera, but some of them were selling for $199, you know, $200 for this thing. And it could fly for 7 minutes. And they have, you know, they have YouTube. You watch this thing. It has LED lights. It looks like you can fly these things at night. What it would look like. But I think it would be great to put up dipoles if you could have some kind of a automatic release, you know, be able to put something high in a tree. That's what I was thinking. I said, this would be great for $200 vacuum.
Whiskey Kilo Bravo, Papa Power with a comment.
I think that was Joe number one again. BMP, go right ahead.
Yeah, I own several of these. If you guys want any information, just go to ardrupilot, ardrupilot.com. Everything is there. Everything is in public domain. They have mission planners with waypoints, and it tells you what the aircraft is doing from your computer or your iPad. It's a whole other system. ardrupilot.com. All your questions will be answered there. Extremely informative.
I thank you, Joe. Good stuff. Anyone else have any further questions or comments with reference to quadcopters, hexcopters, and so on? These pilotless vehicles that are really being piloted from the ground with cameras on board. Give me a call with us right now. Guarantee you're going to be hearing more about those as time goes on. Next person who signed in was Al. But let me give Frank an opportunity. Frank, WB2BXO, I know you wanted to make an announcement. WB2BXO, K2RIW in the second end. Okay, maybe Frank's not available right now. Al, WB2 Papa Zulu Golf. You've got it, Al. K2RIW in the second end.
Yeah, VA3PZG. I had a question about an HF rig. I'm a relatively new ham, although I've been licensed since 93, have been out of the hobby for a little while, and have an HF rig that was working when it was put away 12 years ago, and have been struggling with trying to get it to transmit, and was wondering if there are some hints or tips that you could offer on what I could look for. I'll drop it here for a second.
Yeah, let me interrupt you on this one, Hal. Al, sorry I got your call letters wrong. Tell us what model number of rig it is, because we got an expert on board, Hal, PPZ, who is familiar with any piece of electronics that ham radio operators have ever touched. So what's the model number on your transmitter that's giving you grief? Victor Alpha 3, Papa Zulu Golf, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Yeah, okay, very good. It's a mid-1990s Yaesu FT-747GX. Quite an older rig. Was a mobile rig in around the $1,000 price point in the early 90s. Trying to decide what to do with it. It receives just fine. The transmit is down to maybe a quarter of a watt, just enough to wiggle a power meter, and that's about all. And not sure where to go with this old radio, and even whether or not it's worth working on. So some opinions would be welcome.
Text keep it a comment.
I knew you'd have one. FT-747. Tell us what you know about that one, Hal. K6DPZ, wait for the four beeps. K2RIW in the tech man.
Hey, very good. K6DPZ. 747 was a very low-lying transceiver that came up by Yaesu. And the first thing I would do is open it up. You have to pull little sliders on each side of the radio to open up the case. It's a plastic case. Make sure all the plugs and connections are seated properly. You could have oxidation that built up on the connections, and that's why you have no transmit. That'd be the first thing to do on that radio, and it may just come back to life. Was it working when you put it away?
I was told so. I heard the radio myself, watched it in use, and then about a year later, I inherited the radio in a box. And was told it was fine and working. But like I say, that was 12 years ago, and it's been sitting in my cover here ever since. It's been high and dry and has had, much to worry about sitting in the cardboard box in the top of our closet. But nevertheless, when I powered it up the other day. I did take it apart and had a look inside, but I'm not really sure what I'm looking for. I was just poking around, sticking my nose in there, looking for anything obvious, but nothing seemed to leap out.
Okay, K6DPC. Now, first of all, do you have the original power cable that comes with that radio? It's a 4-pin Jones plug. Or did you just try to put some voltage into the Jones connect, the male Jones connector in the back?
And before you pick up, Al, I also would like to know, what did you use for a source of 12 volts, or 13.8 volts, so to speak? Are you sure that under load, when it was trying to transmit, that your source of power really was putting out, let's say, 13.8 volts? Was it a really stiff power supply that you were using? Victor Alpha 3, Papa Zulu Golf, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Yeah, I will address the power supply. Yes, I can verify it was a 20-amp power supply, 13.8 volts, with a meter indicating voltage, and it has been working on all the other equipment here, which is really just the VHF stuff, so fairly low power requirements. I don't suspect it's a problem with the power supply. It was the original cable that came with that. It was a 4-pin cable with two little steel clips that slide in to hold the cable in place. So that was correct. When I opened the case, I didn't see anything obviously, that's what I thought too, obviously disconnected. But I'm not sure where to go from here. Is this radio worth spending some money and sending it in for a tune-up? Or is this, should I be looking at spending my money somewhere else?
60%. Well, see, you don't know for sure when you got it if it was transmitting. So chances are you may have gotten it where somebody may have knocked out the finals and decided to give it to you in a box as a gift. So, you know, it's a toss-up. If it needs finals and so on and so forth, it's a toss-up if it's worth, you know, putting the finals into it. There's too many variables here I can't give you an honest answer on. When you key it, do you notice the panel lights on the radio dim? When you key it, let's say, the CW position or, you know, the position? Or when you whistle into the mic, do you see the panel lights dim?
And before I pick it over to you, Al, one other question I've got. What was the load? If it was an antenna of unknown standing wave ratio, there's a slim possibility that the standing wave ratio protect circuit is cutting back the power to protect the final. If it was going into a known 50-ohm dummy load, then that problem would go away. VA3, PZG, K2LIW in the group.
Yeah, VA3, PZG. To start with, I'll answer the, I started out because I was hanging up a new G5RV, which I strung up in the air, and that's what I was attempting to tune and see where my SWR was, but I couldn't get any power out of it. I suspected that maybe I had something wrong with the antenna. I did put it onto a dummy load, and I still couldn't get any power coming out of the radio at that point. So I'm trying to decide what I do with the radio, whether I bench it for now. Not sure if it's if it was, and again, this is an opinion question, if anybody wants to jump in. The radio, when it's up and running in good condition, you know, is it a reasonable rig to start out with, or should I be looking for something else?
Yeah, in a minute, I'm going to turn it over to Hal for an answer on that one. But first, did you try it on more than one band? Did you try transmitting 80, 40, 20, 15, and 10 meters into that dummy load? Are you getting a small amount of power on all of those? And Hal's question was, did the lights on the front panel dim when you went into the transmit mode? Over to you, Al, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Did he try CW too, Dick? WS2N?
You've got it, Al.
Yeah, VA3PZG. To be honest, I didn't notice the front panel. I would suspect that yes, it did, but I can't say that for sure. I really wasn't paying enough attention to really notice that. I didn't know to look for it. As far as all of the bands, yes, I did cycle through all of the bands. And like I say, there was almost no movement of the power needle. Couldn't get anything out. So, and like I said, I don't know when it went into the box at what state it was in at that point. So I'm kind of grasping at straws, I guess.
Yeah, I've got a question for Al. Stand by while I get a beep. So, Al, with your experience with the 757, what do you believe it is worth in dollars today? If in the worst case he finds out that the finals have to be replaced, make a rough guess. How expensive are those finals? K6PZG. Here we go. Got your call letters wrong. K2DPZ, K6DPZ, K2RIW in the TechNet.
K2RIW
in the
TechNet, K6DPZ. Okay, first of all, if it's receiving on all bands, and that part is working, 85% of the radio is operational. You said it wouldn't be receiving, then I suspect the phase lock loop, a lot more parts of the radio. If being it's receiving, I would say maybe you lost your drivers, or you may have lost your finals, or you just have a cold solder joint going to the finals over age. I would say it's worth pursuing, because radio working is worth about, I would say between $300 and $400. It's a nice little radio. So if you put $150, under $200 into it, you can't go too far wrong, because it is a very compact set. Eastkit used that same radio for, I believe it was 7400 that came out by Eastkit. It was the same basic radio. If the tuning mechanism in the front, the tuning encoder, does not have a lot of backlash, and it tunes real smoothly, I would say it's definitely worth fixing. It's K6DPZ.
And I sense from what you said, Hal, that if the finals need replacement and he had it done professionally by Yaesu or somebody like that, and then they did a full tune-up, you said $150. If he was a crafty enough guy where he was able to buy the final transistors and replace them himself, what's the approximate price of those final transistors? Over to you, Al.
I would say from RF parts, if I remember correctly, they should be maybe about $35 to $50 a piece. But I would check the final transistors and the drivers before jumping and buying them. You know, it could just be a minor problem. But I would say the set is worth fixing if it's clean and if the tuning mechanism is good. If the tuning dial has play and is flopping around, then I won't waste a lot of money on it, because the optical encoder on that is not that cheap, and you're putting more money into what it's worth.
Yeah, it's too bad that you don't live in the New York City area, Al, because in the New York City area, you've got Hal, we've got Andy, W2CDL. We've got a number of guys who are real skilled at repairing, and this is a club with 400 members, and a number of them are doing repairs. It's quite possible that, I'm guessing you live in the Horseshoe area, I think it's called, or the Golden Horseshoe area of Canada, and as such, if there's a local club, you may find a guy in that club who does troubleshooting. He owns a service monitor, and he knows how to check. You're going to wiggle all those connectors just to be sure that each one of the cables with its socket and plug, so to speak, that none of those have come loose. By the way, you did use a power supply with a voltmeter and an ammeter. Roughly how many amps did it draw in the key down CW mode on any one of the bands you tried? And once again, I think you're going to discover that Canada's got some pretty good guys, if you just get to the right club in the right town, that can do the troubleshooting for you. That may be a way of making it a little bit less grief than sending it back to the factory. VA3PZG, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Yeah, VA3PZG. Yeah, you guys, thank you so much. You've given me, I've been scratching down notes here and things to look for, and kind of given me a ballpark of where it sits. The radio from a cosmetic and a physical standpoint, all the buttons and all the switches, the tuner, everything seems to work very nice. It doesn't look like it's had a lot of use. And that was my understanding when I was given the radio, that it was in very nice shape. So I think it, from what you guys are telling me, that it's probably worth getting someone to look at this. So I will take that to the next step and chase down through some of the local stuff on where I can get this and who can have a look at it. It's a little beyond my knowledge base. As I said, I am just starting out in the HF stuff, so I'm not sure what questions and what things to look for yet, so.
220 with a comment.
Go ahead, Al.
Okay, if ever you find who you find to work on the radio, supposedly works on this type of equipment, he should not need the microphone or the power cord or the manual. He should have all that stuff. If he doesn't have that stuff, I would suggest that he doesn't really have the familiarity that much working on all these Yaesu radios. That's my comment.
You probably replaced vinyls in a rig like that, Hal. I know that vinyl transistors and properly soldering them down and properly heat sinking them and not doing any mechanical damage, there's a bit of skill required there. Do you believe a person who hasn't done that work should even attempt it, or is it something you should be afraid of? What's your gut feel on that one, Hal? K6DPZ, K2RAW in the tech net.
To Echo Oscar and to Leo.
Turn it over to Rick before I give my comments.
Okay, I wonder if you've ever replaced those finals, Rich, into EO, K2RAW.
I remember working on a 757 for Barry into MB many years ago, but don't remember. I think you know, I don't remember everything of what I had to do. What I was going to suggest, Hal cannot talk about his own business, but I can as a as a friend. And what I was going to suggest to the Canadian gentleman is that he get in touch with Hal and talk to him on the telephone and ship the radio to him, because Hal is quite skilled, can probably repair it and turn it around in a short order. And stand by. Let me give you Hal's phone number. 516-303-2051. 516-303-2051. So let me turn it back to Ned. Dick, let me turn it back to you. I don't think that violates anything because I am not in the business. Dick, pick it up and do it.
Okay, I thank you for that information, Rich. Al, VA3PZG, if you need a fill on that information you were just given, please ask for it right now. You've got it, Al.
Yeah, VA3PZG. No, I copied that 100%. All is good. That was some great information. Appreciate that. And I will most likely pursue that direction. Over to net control.
Question, N1YDY. N1YDY, go right ahead. Start off with your name, sir.
Hi, Dick. The name is Hank, and the call is N1YDY. And the question was, are we talking about a HeatKit SB1400?
Hank, we're talking about a Yaesu FT-747GX, Yaesu FT-747GX, N1YDY, K2RIW, you've got it, Hank.
SB1400.
Okay, I was going to say is that I have a set of finals for that radio if he's interested in the aluminum box. It's got a bad low-pass filter board on it, but if he wants the box, he can have it.
Okay, that's a great offer. It looks like Al, a guy named Hank, November 1 Yankee, Delta Yankee, has just offered you a set of final transistors for that rig. Wonder if you need a fill on that one, Al. VA3PZG, K2LIW in the tech net.
Yeah, VA3PZG. I will need a fill on that one. I was scrambling to copy that call. If I could get that call again, that'd be great.
I'm waiting long enough to make sure the machine sets. So the guy who just made that offer was Hank, November 1 Yankee Delta Yankee. And Hank, what's the easiest way that Al from Canada can make contact with you? If he goes to QRZ.com, will he be able to get enough information to find your phone number or will that mailing address? What's the easiest way he can get in contact with you if he wants to follow through with your great offer, Hank? November 1, Yankee, Delta Yankee, K2LIW in the TechNet.
Okay, the best way to get hold of me is to use my call sign at yahoo.com.
Okay, November 1, Yankee, Delta Yankee. November 1, Yankee, Delta Yankee at yahoo.com. Let's see if Al's got that, and BA3PZG, K2LIW in the TechNet.
Yeah, VA3PZG. Yes, I've been madly writing here. Hank, thank you very much. I will contact you via email, and we can do it via email and make that that connection. That would be fantastic. That might just get me everything I need to get this radio on the air.
Steve, please hear the comment before I go. You got it, Al. I mean, Al. DP said you got it.
It's just waiting. If you get that PA section with the radio, send both of those things in at the same time. If those things are available, I will do as necessary to use his section in your radio. It would not make it a major repair.
Looks like you've got a great offer there, Al, PZG. So by Hank's final transistors and by Al's repair experience, I think you're going to be rolling. VA3PZG for any final comments. K2LIW in the TechNet.
Yeah, VA3PZG. Yeah, gentlemen, this has been a fantastic night for me. Was quite enjoying the discussion around the dipole wire material, and now on to this. It's been fantastic. I appreciate all the assistance and all the help. I will definitely be in touch with Hal and Hank via other modes, and we'll go from there. VA3PZG.
Final comment from Hank?
Go right ahead, Hank.
Yeah, I think it would be best then if once Hal got the device in the mail or however it gets there, that I give Hal the stuff rather than sending it to Canada and sending them both to Hal that way.
Okay, if I understand you correctly, N1YDY, I guess you're offering to drop ship the finals directly to K6DPZ and not even go through the weight of getting it up to Canada and then Canada mail everything back down to Hal, is what I think you're saying. I believe that's your recommendation, Hank. N1YDY for a correction, K2LIW in the TechNet.
I think it would certainly save on shipping and customs and all the rest of those things.
Here's another comment. Is this the whole module, or are you going to pull the finals off the module you have existing?
You got it, Hank.
Hadn't thought it through, Hal. I know the LP board is bad. You can see a couple of inductors are fried, but it does have good output on bands other than that particular one where they were fried. So I haven't decided whether I was going to pull the module or pull the board out of the module. It's the easiest.